Well, Buncombe County District Attorney Todd Williams, welcome back to Blue Ridge Public Radio. It's good to have you here.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. And I've been giving a listen to 107.9. It's a great new service.
We were going to do this interview a few weeks ago, but you were occupied. You're a new father. Well, you've just had your second.
I have a newborn son. He's five weeks and a day at this juncture.
Congratulations.
Things are going well, and I'm mostly sleeping, but I did do a little dawn patrol in the early morning.
So you feel better prepared this time around since you've already had one child so far? You think you're better equipped for this?
Yeah, I think the second time around we're much more relaxed.
So you've been on the job now for 2.5 years. What are some of the big highlights for you?
Well, looking back over the last 2.5 years, there's two keystone moments, I guess, that really kind of define, I guess, my tenure. We've had a number of big cases, but perhaps the most noteworthy case is the State versus Robert Jason Owens. We're just talking about an extremely tragic and grotesque homicides of a married couple and a mother-to-be carrying an unborn child. So effectively, it was a triple homicide. This landed on my desk in March of 2015, and here in April, in the past month or two, we were able to bring that to a close. It was a capital. I mean, Mr. Owens contended that his truck was stuck in a ditch, and CODs were providing assistance. The truck lurched, ran them over. This was, again, his contention. And then he backed over them again to ensure that they had passed. This was his statement. And then, not knowing what else to do, the best choice he felt he had was to take them back to his place and dismember their remains and place them into his buck stove and essentially cremate them. So, I mean, we're talking about facts that are extremely unusual and very, very disturbing. We declared it capital for obvious reasons. If there is a case that deserves to be prosecuted capitally, it would have been that. But we also had a situation where Mr. Owens had control of their residence for some 72 hours and was able to dispose of many things, including, we're talking about human remains. Mm-hmm. We were never able to identify through genetic testing remains that went to Christy Schoen. And therefore, without identification of Ms. Schoen, we certainly didn't have additional proof of remains of the baby-to-be. So, I mean, we're talking about very, very serious facts here.
Yeah.
And a grieved set of families. And fortunately, we got enough of an admission from Mr. Owens to hold him to account for what he had done. We charged him with first-degree homicides, murder of an unborn child, and dismemberment, in addition to other offenses. He pled guilty to the dismemberment. He ultimately pled to second-degree murder, and we were able to get a term of years of 60 years for those offenses. And we had the support of the families. We spent a lot of time with the families, helping them to understand that the word isn't closure. Mm. Word just simply is not closure. They're going to suffer for the remainder of their lives, with the absence of their loved ones. But in terms of legal closure, we have folks here in North Carolina sitting on death row that were convicted in the 80s, in the early 90s. There hasn't been an execution in the state of North Carolina in 11 years. In addition, if we had obtained convictions before, the deaths of JT and Christy, capital convictions, their remains would have been placed in the evidence locker and would have remained there until Mr. Owens either passed naturally or by means of execution. So there were personal significance to how we handled this case to the families. For me as district attorney, I needed to ensure that Mr. Owens goes away. And from my perspective, his signature on a plea transcript, waiving all those, appellate issues and post-conviction issues, in a case like this, we've got him, maintaining control of the crime scene for 72 hours, going to such, dramatic lengths to dismember, dispose of human remains. His signature on that paper to take 60 years was worth a lot, and it is worth a lot to the families, and I think all of us, because it slams the door on him. He's gone for 60 years minimum. People ask me, well, is there any chance after 20 years he might be? No. He brought him to custody at age, I want to say 37. It'd be 96 and a half at the earliest before he's out, but he could be in until I want to say like 114. Okay. So there's a range, there's minimums and maximums. The minimum is 59 and a half years. And he signed up for that. He's in the custody of the state, and that's where he'll stay.
So you signed up for the job, obviously, but I wonder, a case like this where you have to deal with something so, as you said, disturbing, and where you're also getting so much pressure, I'm sure, because there's a lot of emotion involved, and some people want to see this guy go away for life. Some people want to see him put to death. What is the job like?
I certainly am sensitive to all those pressures. But for me, you know, I was well tested. For years I was a public defender and a capital defender, and, you know, worked with families in many different cases with just about every kind of pressure and concern and whatnot. And sitting down with folks and really, you know, explaining them how the legal system works and what their options are, mm-hmm. kind of comes naturally to me. So the external pressures are new, but in terms of what I really focused on was how can I work with these families to help them understand and get some peace out of this? And that's what I stayed focused on.
I see, yeah.
So in terms of what my job actually was, my job is to make the call. What's appropriate? What is justice? And I guess what I'm explaining to you is the circumstances of this case were very challenging. You know, our ultimate goal is always to achieve justice, mm-hmm. is to get justice. And the folks most intimate to it were key to achieving justice. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, to a lesser degree, as district attorney, I've got to get the consent of the community. And you know, nothing less than an effective, what is effectively a life term was acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had mentioned two things.
Certainly the Owens case. And we spent a lot of time on the officer-involved shooting in West Asheville. A very tragic circumstance for our community, certainly for the victim, Jerry Williams. We're seeing the resolution of all of it now, really. I mean, you know, just in the past week, we've seen the verdict in the Philando Castile case. That occurred July 6th. Well, our event here in Asheville was July 2nd. And I think there was sort of a lot of sort of cross-pollination. And the Philando Castile case was the live-streamed Facebook event,
yeah.
right? You know, which was extremely dramatic and you know, shocking,
yeah.
really to watch.
And the Jerry Williams case happened right after the incident in Charlotte, shortly after.
You're right to point that out. But the Charlotte event occurred later that, I want to say, late summer, early fall.
I see.
But yeah, there was that, and then there were obviously riots in Charlotte, and
yeah. So obviously, a lot of external pressure in a case like this.
That's absolutely correct. But what we knew we had an early stage here was, you know, there was a dispute. Jerry Williams had a firearm. He had an assault weapon, a Bushmaster XM15. We commonly hear about AR-15s. This is a close cousin of an AR-15.
I see.
He brought this firearm with him to Pisgah View Apartments, discharged it. There were calls for assistance from Pisgah View Apartments, and APD came, Asheville Police Department came, to address the threat to that community. There was a high-speed chase through West Asheville. That ended in Deverview. And, you know, what we elected to do is, because we had very clear witness statements from the two women that were in the car, both indicating that it appeared to them that he did in fact have this weapon and intended to use it against the officer. We uploaded that to YouTube. We provided those materials to the press. And these are ongoing concerns nationally, right? Mm-hmm. I think it did bring a measure of peace to our community to know that, it was Tyler Radford, Officer Radford, you know, discharged his weapon only under, you know, the threat of, you know, he was facing a deadly threat. And, you know, this was not an excessive use of force. In the past, it hasn't really been protocol to release documents and evidence from criminal investigations. Mm-hmm. But the term responsible transparency has been used among my colleagues. And I think that I'm proud of that. I'm proud of what we were able to do to provide what I hope is some assurance to our community, especially to the impacted community, Deverview and Pisgahview, that, you know, the facts and circumstances were as they were.
So we're talking on the day after the North Carolina House gave final approval to the state budget. So included in the budget, which is now headed to Governor Cooper's desk, is a 40% cut to the Department of Justice and the Attorney General's office. I wonder your take on the impact that could have both statewide and locally and with you.
Well, yeah, this is a surprise. The AG's office does an awful lot, but as it intersects with our business, you know, we're a trial unit in the DA's office. We don't have an appellate bureau. When we get a conviction, in the case, murders, homicides, first-degree homicides, automatically go up to Court of Appeals as appeal as of right. It's automatic appeal. Somebody from the state of North Carolina needs to represent the state. And we don't have that facility within our office. We don't have the resources. Again, we're a trial unit. Those cases are handled by the Department of Justice and the Attorney General's office. From what I understand, these cuts will occur among that staff. So the legislature has created 37 new ADA, assistant district attorneys, across the state. We're not getting a new position here in Buncombe County. So it doesn't appear that we're going to have, like, resources are being transferred to another agency. The state does fund the appellate defender's office on the defense side. And there's court-appointed counsel for defendants, for indigent defendants who will, you know, file their appeals and briefs and whatnot. So who's going to do this work? Who's going to ensure that violent criminals remain in custody on appeal?
So you're saying
if not the Department of Justice, who's going to do it? I don't know what the solution is. If they're cutting the Department of Justice, they have already elected to fund appellate counsel at the next level.
Yeah.
So is the state creating an imbalance? Is it, you know, as a society, we agree, you know, due process is due. But there's a public safety issue. We want our convictions, hard-fought jury trials, to be looked at an appellate level. We want to do it without error. But let's have somebody to argue. You know, let's have somebody to argue on our behalf. Let's have due process at that level as well. If there's nobody to carry our arguments with us up to the next level, that's not fair.
Right. So fair to say that you're troubled by those cuts.
Yes, I'm troubled by those cuts. And I haven't heard what solution the legislature proposes to replace that staff with, those resources with. We need to have due process at the appellate level. The state is funding counsel for defendants at that level. Is the state cutting resources that will ensure that, you know, criminal defendants who have been convicted at jury trial, or are they going to remain in custody? And a lot of these folks are violent. There's a public interest in continuing to prosecute those cases at the appellate level. And that's effectively what the AG's office does by filing briefs on behalf of the state to ensure that due process on behalf of the public is, you know, continues.
Josh Stein, through legislation, working with lawmakers, has made a real push to tackle the opioid crisis. Do you see any negative impact to that effort with cuts to Department of Justice?
Well, it's too early to even really predict, but, you know, there's so many things happening right now. You know, a common refrain is that we're not going to arrest and prosecute our way out of the opioid situation. We've got, you know, the issues, they're perhaps more political. We've got, you know, the healthcare debate going on in Washington. You know, a lot of resources come out of, you know, the federal budget, Medicaid.
How much involvement do you have as district attorney in this crisis that we have going on with opioids?
Well, we have recently rolling out the opioid diversion program, which, you know, what we commonly see is pain management. We have folks who have worked hard all their lives, have developed bad backs, or injured on the job, are prescribed painkillers. And one thing leads to the next, and then they're charged with, you know, an illicit drug crime. First-time offenders, it's almost more medical or psychological or substance abuse related than it is criminal, right? We really want to give folks a second chance. And this is, again, our ultimate goal is to do justice, not convict merely because we can. So we've created the opioid diversion program. We have other programs as well, drug treatment court, veterans treatment court, where the goal is to provide rehabilitation and set the quote-unquote offender, and what we're talking about here is first-time offenders, back on their feet and back on a path to, you know, compliance with the law and back to work, paying taxes, rather than you know, paying probation fees or sitting, you know, in custody. We prosecute these cases, but we're looking for creative ways to do justice.
So it sounds like you're kind of on board with Josh Stein and Governor Cooper in terms of, like you said, that common refrain of we can't arrest our way out of this problem, favoring more of a treatment type approach to this issue rather than a prosecutorial one. Is that fair to say?
By and large, we favor more of a treatment approach, but there are numerous steps, right?
Sure.
You know,
a
first offender gets diversion. There's a second charge, you know, at a later date after that first opportunity. And there's other options. We have things where we can place folks on probation and then on the back end, dismiss the charge and the conviction can be expunged. So that's a second layer. A third layer would be drug treatment court, where, you know, there's actually a plea in Superior Court to a felony charge. They're placed on full felony probation. And once they graduate through drug treatment court, you know, again, charge can be dismissed and expunged. So there are multiple layers where we can do justice at different levels. But in terms of intractable substance abuse, if it leads to other criminal conduct, we are charged with protecting the public safety. So I just don't want to, you know, folks to be confused about that.
Right.
By no means are we saying, you know, it's okay. There's going to be a sanction, but we're going to try to do justice, you know, and we feel like we're obligated to treat the substance abuse issue together with, you know, enforce the law. And by doing so, we don't want to put folks in a hole as they're trying to climb out of one.
Right. Now, on the national level, the United States Attorney General Jeff Sessions has issued, you know, an official proclamation or order, I guess, for prosecutors to pursue the strictest penalties for people involved in drugs. I believe that's right. What practical effect does that have on you? Is that something that comes down that you have to follow some kind of order?
No.
So you don't really have any involvement in that?
No, I mean, you know, I'm trying to, you know, we're trying to be sensitive to our community's needs primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're doing justice, you know, on the state level. We have different actors locally and, you know, and down in Raleigh, then, you know, Jeff Sessions may be able to, I guess, influence the discussion about what's appropriate. But no, I've not paid any particular attention to what his directives have been in regard to the opioid or drug crime.
I see. Okay. And issue. So you think that's possible that maybe others do, you know, like maybe other district attorneys.
Certainly,
Yeah.
I mean, I would say, you know, the U.S. attorney's offices would most directly.
Yeah.
So just to put a fine point on that.
Well, you know, looking back over the 2.5 years that you've been on the job, you know, whether it's related to a case or not, what have been some of the toughest moments, do you think, for you so far?
Well, really, the toughest moments were those two cases.
Yeah.
I mean, those were very challenging. Very challenging in terms of, you know, getting the message out to the public, doing it in a timely way, doing justice for, you know, the victims' families. You know, and I met with Jerry Williams' family. Met with the victims' families in the Owens case, and you know, that's very, very emotional. You know, this is a challenging job. It's incredibly stimulating, and I'm very glad to be district attorney, and I've enjoyed the opportunity to be district attorney.
What are some of your best moments, do you think, over the past few years?
Best moments? There's a lot of good things that happen. You know, just, I guess anecdotally, a youth group from Asheville Parks and Rec toured the courthouse yesterday, came up to my office, and had a bunch of kids in my office, and it was sort of like romper room in there for about 15 minutes. And I'm just saying, there are benefits to the job. There's some fun things that happen.
Yeah,
it's not just a crown of thorns.
Yeah. What do you think about some of the challenges for the city of Asheville? I mean, obviously, we've got the police have been pushing for more budgeted money and got some money in the budget, I believe. And so obviously there's some challenges there, obviously growth. But, you know, what do you think the city of Asheville is
dealing with? Well, I'm going to give you kind of just, this is not Todd Williams, the district attorney, so much as it's just, is more, you know, just sort of Todd Williams, the guy, I think we're not doing very well in terms of upward mobility. Very frequently we hear about issues pertinent to racial equity and law enforcement, but they also go to education, you know, healthcare, housing, there's really a sort of systemic environment here that does feed into law enforcement issues. There are big policy questions there that, you know, start at city council, go to the county commission, go to the state level, and all the way up to Washington, D.C. Are we getting to the crux, you know, of what the issues really are? Or is it convenient to pick on, and this is just sort of, again, is it convenient to pick on an agency or two, you know, and say the core of the problem lies there, as opposed to, you know, decisions that have been made over the last 50, 60, you know, perhaps even, you might say, 500 years. But it's good to have the discussion.